David Blight, who is director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition, and professor of history at Yale. I don't know if you noticed, if you become very prestigious, you have very long titles with your name, as David and Jack both do. David has taught at Yale since 2003, and he previously taught at Amherst College. He's the author of several books on the Civil War, including Race and Reunion, The Civil War in American Memory, which won a number of prizes, including the Bancroft Prize, and is also for sale in our gift shop. He also wrote Frederick Douglass's Civil War, Keeping Faith in Jubilee, and Beyond the Battlefield, Race, Memory, and the American Civil War. And what might be of interest to the teachers in the audience is before he became a university professor, David taught public high school for 7 years in his hometown of Flint, Michigan. So we want to welcome him back to Michigan.
Thank you, Judith. It's great to be back. I don't want to admit how many years it's been since I was at the Ford Museum or Greenfield Village. Like many of us, I came here as a child several times. But I want you to know I still have my priorities straight. When I booked my flight to come here for this event, I made sure the Pistons were in town, and I booked tickets for Saturday night's game. So. My subject here is who fought for liberty. And this elastic use of this term liberty, both as a concept and then elastic use of it in as an experience, as a form of historical memory. It may go without saying that liberty is a very difficult liberty, or freedom is a very difficult term to define. Listen to Thomas Jefferson's description from the late 1780s, where he makes what frankly are rather stereotypical descriptions of the differences between Northerners and Southerners. He says, in the North, they are cool, I'm quoting, sober, laborious, independent, jealous of their own liberties, and just to those of others, interested, chicaning, superstitious, and hypocritical in their religion. In the South, however, he says, they are fiery, voluptuary, indolent, unsteady, jealous of their own liberties, but trampling on those of others, generous, candid, without attachment or pretensions to any religion except that of the heart. But note the operative phrase he put in there for both sides, they are jealous of their liberties. Aren't we all? But which liberties? Who gets to define them? Move ahead with me to Abraham Lincoln. In the midst of the Civil War, it's 1864. It's now a war for more than the limited aims of the preservation of the Union or the establishment of Confederate independence. It's now, by 1864, of course, a war for black freedom, a war to destroy slavery, the results of which are yet to be determined. And Lincoln voiced that famous passage where he said, "We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. To the North," said Lincoln, "freedom meant for each man," I'm quoting, "to enjoy the product of his labor. But to the Southern whites, it conveyed mastership, the power to do, quote, as they please with other men and with the product of other men's liberty." Who fought for liberty in the Civil War? Well, everybody did. Everybody said they did. That's indeed how elastic such a concept is. Everybody fought for liberty. Let's take secession just for a moment. A huge controversial question: is the right of secession a right or not constitutionally? I'll leave that for the moment. And maybe Jack can help us on that later. But to Lincoln, of course, he took the strict Unionist position. He believed secession was not only wrong, he claimed it was even impossible. Well, that's a matter of history. You can secede from the Union if you can make it stick. But Lincoln said, in his words, plainly, the central idea of secession is the essence of anarchy, a majority held in restraint by constitutional checks and always changing only easily is the true sovereign of a free people. When one rejects it, one does so of necessity and flies into anarchy or despotism. Lincoln's position was that position, that unionist position of the Republican Party, secession winter 1860-61, that said they had to take a stand against secession, otherwise the American experiment would end. There would be two nations somehow, always in conflict. But of course, on the other side of this, the Confederacy is born out of a theory of the compact theory of government, the theory of states' rights, a reading of the Constitution. And as all of you teachers know, Southerners had no monopoly on the use of states' rights. In fact, you could argue that Northerners had actually employed the theory of states' rights, even notions of nullification, almost as many times, if not more times, than Southerners in the 80 years or so before the Civil War. Think back to the Hartford Convention of 1814, when it was New Englanders who almost seceded because they were involved in a war that didn't serve their interest. To Jefferson Davis, as many other secessionists, they drew their ideological defense from the claim that the Confederacy, not the United States, the Confederacy was the true legacy or the true vessel of the American Revolution. They said all they were doing was resisting oppressive centralized authority. And after all, what had the American patriots done in the Revolution but resist centralized oppressive authority? What was the difference, they asked. Jefferson Davis in 1861 called the people of Richmond when he arrived May 30th, 1861, to take over as president of the Confederacy in the new Confederate capital. As he arrived, he called the people of Richmond. He said to them, "I look upon you as the last best hope of liberty." What a wonderful irony. Lincoln, of course, is later in 1862 to call the United States the last best hope of earth. The South, he said, Jefferson Davis, was fighting against, quote, tyranny, and fighting for, quote, the sacred right of self-government and the privileges of free men. Who fought for liberty? Everybody. Davis also said, "We may well rejoice," this is still 1861, he changes his tunes through the war when he has to justify the Confederacy. "We may well rejoice," he said, "that we have forever severed our connection with a government that thus tramples on all the principles of constitutional liberty." Whose constitution? Whose liberty? I'll leave the question of why the South seceded from the Union largely, except to say, this is, of course, still a hot issue in the United States. As many of us in our business know, as I lecture hinder and yon, not only in the South, millions of Americans are still growing up, somehow being taught or believing that this war was not really about slavery. It had to be something else. Yeah, it was slavery, but it had to be the difference of the economies. It had to be different conceptions of the Constitution. It couldn't have just been slavery. But all I would do is urge you to read this lovely little book. It's been out only 3 years now, called The Apostles of Disunion by Charles Dew, which studies the dozens of secession commissioners who were sent by the lower slave states, the lower southern states, who had just seceded. As all you teachers know, seven southern states secede between December and February of 61. The rest of the Confederacy, the Upper South, doesn't secede until after Fort Sumter. But in that meantime, the southern states sent commissioners to all these other southern states to try to convince them to secede. And amazingly, no one had ever studied their speeches and their letters and their reports, of which there are dozens and dozens and dozens, and to a man, whether it's the Alabama commissioner or the Georgia commissioner or the South Carolina commissioner, they all go out and say, "We are fighting to preserve our slave property. We are fighting to prevent the Republican Party in the North from creating a society of racial equality." all of their explanations for secession come back to the preservation of a slave labor society. I'll leave that as a question we could come back to. Somewhere in their bones, wrote the great Southern poet Robert Penn Warren, somewhere in their bones, he said, most Americans have a storehouse of lessons drawn from the Civil War. Exactly what all those lessons should be and who gets to determine them has been one of the most contested questions in American national memory, at least since, I think, 1863, when Robert E. Lee retreated back into Virginia, when Lincoln went to Gettysburg to try to explain the meaning of the war in November of 63, and when Frederick Douglass, also in November of 63, took a speech on the road called The Mission of the War, in which he declared, quote, national regeneration to be the sacred significance of the Civil War. Among all the possible lessons from that war, said Robert Penn Warren, is the realization, these are his words, that slavery looms up mountainously in the story and can never be talked away. But Warren acknowledged another lesson of equal importance, I think for all Americans. When one is happy in forgetfulness, said Warren, facts just get forgotten. Or as William Dean Howells put it in a lovely passage in 1900, what the American public always likes is a tragedy as long as it has a happy ending. Think with me just for a minute about the way Americans have remembered the Civil War, down certainly to the 50th anniversary, which is what I'll end on, but I think right on through the 20th century to this very moment in time. There were basically three kinds of Civil War memory in our culture. At least, that's what I did when I wrote my book on. I did what all historians do. I boiled things down to some kind of trinity because we can't get our heads around four ideas. So there were three kinds of memory. The first we can call the reconciliationist memory, which took root in the process of dealing with the dead on so many battlefields and in prisons and from so many hospitals, a scale of death that Americans had never experienced and have never experienced since. And this reconciliationist vision developed in many ways earlier than the embittered history of Reconstruction might lead us to believe. The second kind of memory of our Civil War we might call white supremacist memory, which took many forms early, including terror and violence, locked arms with reconciliationists of many kinds, and eventually delivered the country a racially segregated memory of its Civil War on Southern terms by certainly the turn of the 20th century and well through the 20th century. And the third kind of memory we might call the emancipationist memory, which was embodied in African Americans' complex remembrance of their own freedom, and there was no single black memory of what emancipation or slavery had meant. It was also rooted in the politics of radical Reconstruction and in conceptions of the war as the, it's what Douglass called it, conceptions of the war as the reinvention of an American republic, the birth of the second American republic, redefined through the liberation of African Americans to citizenship and constitutional equality, at least the beginnings of it. In the end, this was or has been a story of how the forces of reconciliation overwhelmed that emancipationist vision in our national culture, and how an inexorable drive for reunion both used and trumped race. But the story didn't merely dead end in the bleakness of the age of segregation after the turn of the 20th century. So much of that emancipationist vision persisted in American culture during the early 20th century, upheld by blacks and a fledgling neo-abolitionist tradition, that it never died a complete death on the landscapes of Civil War memory. That persistence of an emancipationist vision and its revival made possible the the revolution and transformation of American society through the civil rights movement in the latter part of the 20th century. Americans faced, I think, an overwhelming task. It did overwhelm the culture. After the Civil War and after emancipation, they had to understand this tangled relationship between two profound ideas. And think now how much this elastic notion of liberty is all caught up in it. One of those profound ideas was healing, and the other was justice. On some level, both had to occur. But given the potency of racism and its power in 19th century America, these two aims of healing and justice never developed in any kind of historical balance. One might conclude that this imbalance between the outcomes of sectional healing, North and South, and racial justice, Black and white, were simply America's inevitable historical condition, and then celebrate the remarkable swiftness of that American reunion from so bloody a civil war. But theories of inevitability, of irrepressible conflicts or irrepressible reconciliations are rarely satisfying. Historians hate inevitability because if things really are inevitable, there's no need for us to explain anything. Human reconciliations, I would say, you know, when tragically divided people can actually find each other again around some kind of common aspirations or nationalism or ideas or patriotism or whatever, are to be cherished. And God knows the world is full now of this desperate need for human reconciliation between cultures, nations, societies, borders, neighbors. But sometimes reconciliations, history shows us, come at the expense of terrible costs. The sectional reunion after so horrible a civil war in America was a political triumph by the late 19th century. But it could not have been achieved without, it certainly wasn't achieved, without the resubjugation of most of those people the war had freed from centuries of slavery. This was, I think, the tragedy lingering on the margins and infesting the heart of American history from Appomattox until at least World War I and beyond. For many white Americans, especially veterans and their family members, healing from the war was simply never the same proposition as doing justice to the 4 million emancipated slaves and all their descendants. On the other hand, a simple justice, a fair chance to exercise basic constitutional liberties and secure access, perhaps, to land, livelihood, were all most blacks ever really demanded out of the Reconstruction years and beyond. They sought no official apologies, by and large, for slavery. What they most wanted was protection, education, security, human recognition, maybe a helping hand from government. The rub, of course, was that there were so many warring definitions of what healing was supposed to mean in the South in particular. And the nation's collective memory had never been in this condition of being shattered like it was. In the wake of our Civil War, we had no Truth and Reconciliation commissions through which to process either the memories of slavery or the experience of total war, which of course white Southerners experienced more than anybody. Defeated white Southerners and black former slaves by the millions faced each other on the ground, seeing and knowing an awful chasm between their experiences, unaware, in the end, whether there was any path to their reconciliation. Yankee and Confederate soldiers, the thousands upon thousands of veterans from this war, would eventually find a smoother path to bonds of fraternalism and a sense of mutual glory that wouldn't come quickly and easily, but it did come. As is always the case in any society trying to master the most conflicted elements in its past, healing and justice had to happen in history and through politics. Americans have had to work through the meaning of their Civil War and its outcomes, and the only place they could, in the politics of memory. And I would suggest that as long as we have a politics of race in America, and it hasn't gone away, we're likely to have a politics of Civil War memory. Now, I could go on about all of this question of memory, but I think I will simply end with a story of how this played out, particularly down to the 50th anniversary of the war. By the 50th anniversary, 1911 to 1915, and we're now planning the sesquicentennial of the. I just went to the first meeting in Chicago of the at the Chicago Historical Society of a group beginning to plan the. It's never too early, apparently, for the programming for the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. But during this memorial period of the Civil War, the 50th anniversary, and actually this has been going on for years and years, there were many big blue-gray reunions. Blue-gray reunions began back in, they started to try to have them in the 1870s, which were pretty awkward. By the 1880s, they started to happen with some regularity, and by the 1890s, cities all over the country, north and south, were competing every year to host them because they were the biggest conventions you could have. There were 420-some-odd thousand Union veteran members of the Grand Army of the Republic in 1890 alone. If even a decent percentage of them showed up for a convention, it was big money for a city. These were big spectacles, big events. The one plan for Gettysburg in 1913 on the battle's 50th anniversary, greatest battle of the war, was an extraordinary event, and it was the largest blue-gray reunion ever held. But it is also a beautiful, if terrible, window into what happened to Civil War memory in the larger American culture at that time. Let me just briefly describe it. They invited every living Civil War veteran to come to Gettysburg, and the government, it was a combination of money from the War Department and the states, and particularly the state of Pennsylvania, paid their train fare. Well over $2 million was appropriated to put it on, which was a great deal of money in 1913. From its very inception, the committee that planned it called it a festival of harmony. They also labeled it the Peace Jubilee. The theme of it was to be, from the beginning, sectional healing, sectional reconciliation, a public avowal of a glorious fight, as the commission said, that, quote, led to a greater unity. All the governors of all the states attended. Many of them were still Civil War veterans. In fact, you couldn't get elected governor in a southern state without being a Civil War veteran. The governor of Virginia, William Hodges Mann, they all gave speeches. It was endless speech making. But he sort of struck the keynote of the entire event when he said, quote, "We are not here to discuss the genesis of the war, but men who have tried each other in storm and smoke of battle are here to discuss this great fight. We came here, I say, not to discuss what caused the war of 1861, but to talk over the events of the battle as man to man." No time or space was allowed anywhere in the four-day spectacle, which was, by the way, covered by the national press. Every newspaper in the country had front-page photographs of these beautiful, photogenic old veterans with their medals hanging all over them. No time was given or allowed to discuss any causes or consequences of the war. There was no talk of emancipation or the unresolved history of Reconstruction. There was no consideration of the war's arguably second great outcome, which was the disaster of racial reconciliation. Now, nations, when they celebrate themselves, often don't celebrate their disasters. I understand that. But this is what memory is about. It's about remembrance and forgetting. It always is. The Peace Jubilee, as it was called, was a Jim Crow reunion. There's absolutely no evidence, and I looked everywhere, for the presence of black veterans who might have attended. None did in 1913. A few did the 75th Gettysburg reunion in 1937. The only blacks at this huge spectacle were the men who worked as laborers, who built the tent city, built and cleaned the latrines, worked in the mess tents, and handed out blankets. And I have a photograph of them in my book. It was a stunning and photogenic gathering of old soldiers in a massive tent city all over the fields of Gettysburg. They had an enfeebled reenactment by actual participants of part of Pickett's charge. And maybe you've even seen the famous photos of the guys shaking hands across the stone walls. There was a lot of handshaking, a lot of photo ops, if you like. There'd never been such a spectacle of resolution and patriotism put on by Americans. "Thank God for Gettysburg. Hosanna," proclaimed the Louisville Courier-Journal. "God bless us, everyone, alike the blue and the gray. The world ne'er witnessed such a sight as this. Beholding, can we say, happy is the nation that hath no history." Forgetting was good. Through forgetting, one could heal. Well, at a time when lynching had developed into a social ritual of its own horrifying kind, estimated 3,200 Americans, mostly black, lynched between 1890 and about 1915. At a time when this had come about, and when American apartheid had become fully entrenched, virtually all the Jim Crow laws were in place by about 1910 to 1912, and many black leaders at this time, and editors of newspapers in particular, found this sectional love feast at Gettysburg to be more than they could bear. "A reunion of whom?" asked the editor of the Washington Bee, a black paper. "Only those who fought for the preservation of the Union and the extinction of slavery? Or only those who fought to destroy the Union and perpetuate slavery, and who are now employing every artifice known to deceit to propagate a national sentiment in favor of their nefarious contention that emancipation, reconstruction, and enfranchisement of the Negro are a dismal failure?" Black responses to such blue-gray affairs as that one at Gettysburg, and a host of others like it, demonstrated how fundamentally at odds black memories were from this national reunion. In that contradiction lay an American tragedy, not yet fully told by 1913, and one utterly out of place in the discourse at that reunion. On the last day of the reunion, the speaker of the day was none other than Woodrow Wilson, recently inaugurated President of the United States that spring, first Southern-born President of the United States since the end of the Civil War. He didn't want to come. He was a smart politician. His aides came to him, and he had invitation after invitation to come speak, and he kept saying, "No, I don't think I want anything to do with a blue-gray reunion right now. I'm just the first Southern-born president to come to Washington." He'd also just appointed three people to resegregate three agencies of the federal government. He kept turning them down, And one day, 4 days before the reunion, his Treasury Secretary walked in and said, "Mr. President, you don't seem to quite get it. You got to go. You've got to show up. So would you write something?" Presidents also didn't like to go to Gettysburg to speak because they always got compared to Lincoln. Wilson penned his Gettysburg address. They whisked him into town in a train. They put him in the back of a convertible. They took him out to the high water mark of the Confederacy. They took him into the giant tent. He walked in, flanked by the governor of Virginia, the governor of Pennsylvania, a Union veteran, Confederate flag, and Union flag. He walked in. He gave a 10-minute speech in which he concluded with these words. He declared it an impertinence, he said, to discourse upon how the battle went, how it ended, or what it signified. And then he used a refrain. Wilson was a great rhetorician. He said, "What have the 50 years meant? What have the 50 years meant?" And he ended this way. "They have meant peace and union and vigor," he said, "and the maturity and might of a great nation. How wholesome and healing the peace has been. We have found one another again as brothers and comrades in arms, enemies no longer, generous friends rather, our battles long past, our quarrel forgotten. Except," he said, "that we shall not forget the splendid valor and the manly devotion of the men then arrayed against one another, now grasping hands and smiling into each other's eyes. How complete the union has become, how dear to all of us, how unquestioned, how benign and majestic as state after state has been added to this, our great family of free men." He wadded up his papers, they whisked him back into his convertible, back out of town, It was one of those presidential flying visits. He was only there for an hour, and he was off to a vacation in New Hampshire. The Civil War had become thus, by 1913, the quarrel forgotten on the statute books of Jim Crow America. A nation can have too much memory. It can poison us, but a nation can also forget too much. Let me leave you, as it is irresistible, with one of my very favorite Martin Luther King quotes. This is a day when everybody's going to be quoting King a million times over about peace, about justice, about equality, about who we are. I like to quote him about the way history changes. And I think he was dead right. He said, quote, "Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Even a superficial look at history reveals that no social advance ever rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. Every step toward the goal of justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle." Thank you.